Get energized and excited to tell the world, hey, you can call me Catholic. Live from the Christ Cathedral Campus in Garden Grove, California, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Orange County Catholic Radio present Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normanton.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, St. Paul says to think about these things that lift our thoughts and dwell on the blessings that surround us. Who can argue with that? Of course, we like talking about these things, too, and so we hope St. Paul would approve of us taking it from the cerebral into the audio version of that message. That's what we try to do on Call Me Catholic every week. I am Peggy Normanton, and you have arrived at Call Me Catholic, an hour of hopefully uplifting conversation that is intended to affirm, explore, and celebrate our Catholic identity in these modern times so we can wake up and say to the world each and every day, oh, yeah, you can call me Catholic. Jimmy G is in the house. He is our definitive, our only engineer, actually, and chief fact checker for Call Me Catholic.
You know what? I wasn't feeling uplifted a few moments ago, but you just uplifted
Did
me.
Did I lift
yes.
you up?
I'm so uplifted.
That's my intention. Well, you uplift me. It's kind of a mutual admiration society
right on,
here.
Right on.
Hey, you know, it's funny. I was reading a book the other day, and one of the characters was named Jimmy G.
Really?
I thought you were the only Jimmy G. You've been deceiving me all these
there's
years.
There's like a seafood restaurant in Denver or something called Jimmy G's. Yeah, I think I need to get a t-shirt from
that. Well, were you called Jimmy G when you were younger, like in high school or college or anything? You know, is that kind of more professional?
Looking way back to my early days in college radio, I remember one of my instructors said, you should go by Jimmy G. And I thought, if I ever do like a serious, if I'm doing serious news or serious traffic
that's
reports,
not gonna work.
You know, it's not going to fly. So I didn't go with it.
Here's your White House correspondent, Jimmy G.
This now, is little, Jimmy G reporting.
Little credibility factor there. Well, speaking of names, of course, we have the royal couple came out yesterday and announced the new baby name. Louis Arthur Philip. Yeah, Louis Arthur Charles.
Ah.
I was kind of hoping that they would go with Thomas somewhere in the name because, of course, giving a little peace offering to the Catholics for the Thomases that their kings have destroyed and martyred in the name of their kingdom.
There's so much weight into the name they give, right?
I know. But that really did make quite a splash when she arrived on the hospital steps with her brand new baby, her red dress, heels, looking absolutely beautiful.
Looking perfect, yes.
Well, they are a darling couple, and we applaud them for, you know, growing their family above the average birth rate in Great Britain and Europe. So
yes.
Congratulations to the royal couple, and welcome to the world, baby Louis.
Yes.
And God rest the soul of little Alfie Evans, also from Great Britain. We don't need to go into that story, but that is a very, very sad story. Now, I would like to throw out at this time an invitation to watch our show. Yes, you can listen to us, or you can watch us on Facebook. We have a live stream of the show going on our Facebook page right now. Just go to Facebook.com/callmecatholic, and Marvelous Matt, our studio assistant, has put up a screen that shows exactly what we're doing here in our little studio high atop the Tower of Hope on the very, very beautiful and stunning Christ Cathedral campus here in Orange County, California. We are the Diocese of Orange. Got quite a bit of construction going on the campus right now. Of course, we're rebuilding the interior of the former Crystal Cathedral, formerly in the ownership of Reverend Robert Schuller, God rest his soul. And that's going through an interior renovation to bring it to its full glory as a Catholic place of worship. And then kind of in the center of the campus, we're building a shrine to Our Lady of Louvain.
Right.
And I love that we're going to have a Marian centerpiece in the campus because there's lots of biblical art, but it came from Reverend Schuller's ministry.
Right.
And I think we should be making some Catholic statements here, too. So now I've mentioned frequently over the last few weeks since Easter how much I love these readings that we're hearing right now during this season of Easter from the Acts of the Apostles. And it is technically still Easter because it will remain Easter until Pentecost Sunday on May 20th. And this Sunday's first reading from the Acts of the Apostles kind of tells the story of Saul now having been consumed by the Spirit of Christ and received a direct message from Jesus, goes and meets the apostles in Jerusalem for the first time, some of them encountering him for the first time, and how they are very understandably frightened of him and put off by his reputation and his past, and he has to overcome that. I think Barnabas comes in and sort of intercedes on his behalf and speaks on his behalf. So it wasn't long before Paul had a lot of credibility with the disciples, though.
Amen.
But the reading really still does bring to our attention how difficult it is to overcome our past actions. The past stays with us. It doesn't define us, but it does shape us, and it does kind of follow us. Most of us would really like to sort of sterilize, sanitize our personal history, get rid of those chapters where we did some stupid things or made some poor choices. However, those really difficult passages in life, when we struggled and when we stumbled, those are really often turning points in our story, in our faith. Mm. Those are the crucibles that turn us to God, because we've run out of human resources pretty much at that point. Our guest today wrote a book about this very subject. It's the story of his recovery from drug and alcohol addiction and the stories of those he met along the way. Scott Wieman is the author of The 12 Steps and the Sacraments, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery. And of course, the 12 steps being, of course, the famous 12-step process defined by the Alcoholics Anonymous Creed. But in his book, Scott weaves that successful formula for recovery into a relationship with our sacraments and builds a really solid case for leaning into the sacramental life of our church for complete healing from addictions of all sorts. Now, you're going to love meeting Scott Wieman in just a minute. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation, too. But first up, it is our Call Me Catholic Countdown of the Week, which is going to be, in honor of our theme, the top five saints who suffered from addictions. So this comes under the category of every saint has a past, every sinner has a future, right? Yep, there's nothing new under the sun. If you have a problem, if you're struggling with something, there was a saint that went ahead of you and struggled with it too and overcame it. So here we go. These are my top five saints who struggled with addictions.
The Call Me Catholic Countdown.
Thank you, Jimmy G, for that introduction. Okay, number five. Let's just get him out of the way first. St. Augustine. Augustine was no stranger to lust. In fact, if he was living in today's world, he would probably call himself a sex addict. He writes this in his Confessions. The enemy held my will, and of it he made a chain and bound me. Because my will was perverse, it changed to lust, and lust yielded to become habit, and habit not resisted becomes necessity. Mm. So necessity. He felt as if he needed that sexual pleasure all the time. So what brought about the change in his heart? Okay, so in his Confessions, he also writes that there was a day that his soul was so tormented by his own sin that a mighty storm arose in him, bringing on a flood of tears. And he heard a child's voice saying, take and read. And he picked up the scripture, read Romans, and, you know, from that point forward, was a converted man.
Wow, amazing.
Thanks to a lot of his mother's prayers, which brings me to number four. So I got to mention St. Monica. Now, St. Monica is the mother of St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. She was not an addict. She was not an alcoholic. But, excuse me, she is the patron saint of alcoholics, because I think she had, she prayed so much for her son and for her husband, who was a ne'er-do-well. But Augustine does mention a little story in his Confessions about when his mother was a girl, she would be sent down to the cellar to bring up wine from the big cask of wine down there to her parents. And so she would take little sips of the wine, and then she would just drink the whole goblet as a girl. And her maidservant saw her doing this and said, you're just a wino, basically. Wow. And so she stopped at that point, never did it again. So maybe that's why she had a little bit more compassion. And today she is the patron saint of alcoholics. So keep her in mind if you're struggling with that. Okay, number three would be a Chinese saint named Saint Mark Ji Tianzhang. He was an opium addict. Now, he was not a former opium addict. He was an opium addict at the time of his death, and yet he died a saint. So how did this happen? Well, he was a very successful doctor in China, and this was like at the end of the 1800s, and a very good man, too. And he helped the poor, and he was a very professional, very well-respected doctor. But he developed a stomach ailment. Now, at that time, you treated a stomach ailment with opium. So in treating himself with opium, he became addicted to it. He realized he was addicted to it. He couldn't overcome his addiction. He went to his confessor time and time again, confessed his addiction.
Amazing.
To the point where finally after 30 years or so, his confessor said, stop, enough. You're not really committed to reforming yourself and ridding yourself of this sin, so I will confess you no longer. And he stopped receiving the sacraments, but he did not stop being a very, very faithful Christian. Well, come the 1900, and the Boxer Rebellion broke out in China, where the militia came in and were trying to put down all the Christian missionaries and people that practice Christianity. Mm-hmm. So St. Mark Tianzhang saw this as his opportunity to become a saint, because he and his family were rounded up, and he did not declare himself anything but a Christian. He would not deny Jesus in front of everyone. He had an opportunity. He didn't. They threw him in prison, And then they marched them all off to be beheaded. And he said, I want to go last. I don't want anyone in my family to die alone. So martyr me last. So he was martyred. He was beheaded as a Christian, as an opium addict.
Wow.
Isn't that a pretty powerful story?
Ooh, okay. What a story.
Number two is the Venerable Matt Talbot. Now, I hold this man very near and dear in my heart because he's Irish. He grew up in Dublin following the potato famine, and there were pretty gritty, grim living conditions in Dublin unless you were a fortunate one. And so a lot of people turned to drink. You know, the Irish have that little melancholic propensity. And unfortunately, by the time he was 26 years old, he had sold off everything for the drink. And he was living on the streets. He'd stolen. He'd done everything he could to get his next drink. And at 26, he finally said, no, I'm going to stop. And he did stop cold turkey. It was a very, very difficult process for him. But in doing so, he renounced all his material possessions, started reading scripture daily, going to mass daily, praying about the saints, reading about the saints, and was struggled with his addiction. Died at the age of 69, finally, of a heart attack living on the streets. But there was a huge devotion that spread around him in Ireland because he modeled such self-discipline and perseverance in the midst of such a terrible disease. So he was declared a venerable in 1975 by Pope Paul VI, and I'm sure he will be a saint someday. In the meantime, he is, I'm sure, interceding for a lot of those people in Ireland struggling with that.
These are all amazing stories.
I know. And number one is a saint. I'm trying to cover all the addictions. Saint Camillus de Lellis. Now, I'm not beginning to cover them all. But here is a man. He was a scoundrel. Saint Camillus de Lellis, he was a gambler. He was completely addicted to gambling. He was a 16th century saint, lived in Italy, and he was kind of a mercenary. He was a soldier that could be bought for any cause. And he and his dad were both in the same profession, and his dad was just an itinerant gambler. Everywhere they went, they took their cards and they gambled. And the son picked up the same habit. And so this went on all his life until his dad died and he felt destitute and he was in poor health. So he went to a hospital and he said, if you can cure some of these wounds on my leg, I will work for you. So he started in the hospital and he was starting his new life there. His legs were healing. He was living a good life. He was helping them. But pretty soon he found a deck of cards and he started taking it up with the guys in the hall again, started gambling. So he got kicked out. And this was just a real problem. He was really addicted to the game of gambling. Well, eventually he did make amends. He went on and did incredible work in hospitals, but it wasn't after decades of struggling with a gambling addiction. So there you have it, friends. Five saints who struggled with addictions. Saint Monica's in there because she just deserves a shout out for living with addicts. Now, don't forget to check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/callmecatholic. And you can watch us on the Facebook live stream, too, if you are so inclined. Scott Wieman, author of The 12 Steps and the Sacraments, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery, is up next. We're talking about using the core tools of our faith to help you or someone you know recover from an addiction of any variety. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you are listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Exploring the perils and blessings of embracing a Catholic identity. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hello, friends. How are you doing today? We are glad you've tuned in to Call Me Catholic, and we'll try to make the most of your time with us today. I am Peggy Normandin, and aren't we all kind of creatures of habits? I mean, I have a few defining habitual dependencies in my life. People who know me from college remember my addiction to Tab. And yes, I still drink it today, Tab Cola. And people see me with my pink can.
You still make Tab?
That's what I get all the time. Yeah. I always say I go into a back alley and make the connection. Once every morning I still have my Tab.
Nice.
I'm weaned off of it a little bit. We all have those little behavioral quirks that we build into our daily routine. Maybe you are a gum chewer. Maybe you're a news junkie.
With me, it's Chapstick.
Chapstick user. Okay. Maybe you are obsessed with exercise. We all know people who have to be running or stretching all the time. That's not all bad. It's good to have hobbies and passions and preferences. But when we become a slave to anything in this world that is not God, then we are in dangerous territory. And those habitual patterns can rob us of who God really intends for us to be. Our guest today has lived on the dark side of addictions and, thanks be to God, found his way out at a still very young age and is now committed to helping others find their life's purpose beyond the crippling chain of addiction. Scott Wieman is the author of The 12 Steps and the Sacraments, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery. He is also the founder of Catholics in Recovery, a nonprofit organization that supports those suffering from substance abuse, addiction, and other psychologically hurtful things that we depend upon. Hey, Scott, that was kind of, I kind of faded off there, didn't I, Scott? Welcome to Call Me Catholic.
It's great to be here. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I loved your book. Great book. Really, you pick it up and you don't want to put it down because it's full of so many of your personal stories. It tells the stories of people that you have encountered along your journey. But I would like for our listeners, because not some of them haven't read your book, and I'm sure they're all going to go out and get it, but let's set it up. So 2011, was it? Or
that's right, yeah.
Was that the year when your life kind of changed? And tell us what happened then and where you had been prior to that.
Sure. So October 10th of 2011 is the day that I claim as my sobriety date. It's been since that day that I have not had a drink of alcohol, done drugs, and that's a great miracle.
Congratulations to you.
So let's start there. Let's start with the good news. That,
okay.
The praise Lord, the Lord our Christ is risen.
Yeah.
The crucifixion prior to that, though, was long-lasting. It's kind of, well, progressive, of course. Began when I was in high school, 17 years old.
Well, you said it was actually your confirmation day.
Around there, yeah.
Yeah,
near
okay.
the confirmation day. Then in the book, I draw the line, I received the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and at the same time was being introduced to these other spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And those other
yes.
spirits were a little bit more influential in my life
distilled.
At that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was finding that they could do for me what I couldn't necessarily do for myself mm-hmm. in social situations. And just kind of giving me that warmth, that kind of that freedom, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Moving into college, went to school at New York City on a debate scholarship and worked very hard at that in high school. When I got to college, things were a little bit different, different culture and community. I grew up in a rural town in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
moved to
New York City. That's a big change.
Yeah, it was a change. That one that I was, I had expectations for myself and for other people. The common denominator there was this alcohol and marijuana that I had found in other drugs that kind of helped me bridge the gap from high school to college. And it seemed like mm-hmm. socially appropriate thing to do, a way to get into the, good graces of my peers and you just kind of find myself there. What ended up happening was I ended up losing myself on a regular basis, pretty much from the start, drinking daily, smoking non-addictive marijuana multiple times a day, mm-hmm. turning to selling that then out of my dorm room in order to maintain that lifestyle, that habit, addiction, as I wouldn't have called it then, but it didn't take long
lifestyle
for me to...
Lifestyle is probably what you would have called it.
I would have, right? Yeah. Seeing, people around me doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although without some of the consequences that I had a hard time getting to school the next day or really staying focused on the things that were once of importance, academics, professional growth, and, being a man of virtue, to really kind of dwindling down to just having those basic needs met, what I thought were my needs, and that was to alleviate the anxiety, the mm-hmm. things in my head that were kind of coming as a result of my solution. So my alcohol and drugs were the solution at first. They turned into the problem, and the only way that I knew how to get out of the angst that those consequences brought was to relieve myself with alcohol or drugs. And so that continued a vicious cycle. After three semesters at college, I lost my debate scholarship.
I was going to ask you about your scholarship. Okay.
Yeah, that didn't last long. At 21, I got my second drunk driving citation. Went to rehab for about 15 days. Ended up actually staying sober for about 8 months or so, really white-knuckling it, though,
mm-hmm.
not relying upon any kind of spiritual means to as our alternatives, and then ended up getting drunk again or drinking again. I actually met a woman as I was just kind of towards the end of that 8 months who, a woman from my hometown, from a strong Catholic family, had a lot what I wanted, didn't really know if was living a lifestyle that was rooted in family and faith
mm-hmm.
and having fun too. And so we got together, I started drinking again, and that just ended, began a cycle of a lot of deceitfulness, drug use, infidelity. And we had troubles throughout that relationship. We moved from Wisconsin, where I was living and where I grew up, to San Diego in 2010. That move I likened to changing seats in the Titanic, hoping that you're not going to sink, thinking that the geographic change would...
That's a very dramatic image there. Yes,
yeah.
I don't mean to laugh at it, but
no.
You're right. That's very effective.
I'm hoping for a laugh. That was a change that, thought would leave the problems at home. Of course, that was not... taking on any kind of personal responsibility for any of the problems in the relationship. And so I was just in a spiral where looking for something, but really the only, like, alcohol and drugs had a hold on me, where on a daily basis, you know, my life, once we got to San Diego and I found a job, I was working at a restaurant for a little while, found a day job, I would drink every day. And I would come home from work, get drunk, go to bed, kind of pass out, wake up the next morning, of course, with this anxiety, high anxiety that I would relieve usually with some marijuana, not being able to get out of my bed without it almost. And then getting into work and just maybe on the way home, on the way to work, thinking to myself, you know, this is going to be the day that things are going to change. I can't live with the darkness. You know, I live just physically, emotionally, just dark. Life had lost its color.
And except for those moments of artificial stimulation.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So that's where you go back to those that were in over.
Yeah, I'd make this proclamation that I'm going to make a change today on my way to work. By noon, I'd have enough hydration and caffeination to think to myself, maybe that was an overreaction. And then start looking forward
maybe
to
tomorrow. I'll be better tomorrow.
Exactly. Tomorrow is always tomorrow. When I was in school, tomorrow would be the day that I go in, you know, talk to my professor, see what I can do to get back in class or getting. And then I would just get the craving. The craving would start. I would not even be able to wait till I got home, but stop at the liquor store on my way home, typically buying a bottle of vodka, large bottle of Gatorade, drinking about two-thirds or a third of the Gatorade, filling it with vodka while still sitting in my car in the parking lot of the liquor store. So that I would have a ride for my commute home, because I couldn't even wait to get home.
So you went from it being sort of a social crutch to being literally your body is saying, I can't operate without this.
Yeah, but it was in such a subtle in a way that I couldn't even think that way. It was just like, it seemed as though my car drove itself to the liquor store on a daily basis.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that is not trying to excuse personal responsibility from it, but there's a... Yes, so certainly mechanisms that seem to drive, like, whereas, like, you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, my mind almost had itself set on the fact that my first and most important need is alcohol and drugs.
You're the foundation of your pyramid. Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Scott Weiman. We're hearing this very powerful testimony from Scott Weiman, who is the author of The 12 Steps and the Sacraments. If you have a question for Scott, our phones are not up to snuff today, but we are taking calls. We are taking questions from our Facebook page. So feel free to shoot away any experiences that you want to share or comments or question that you have for our fine guest today. Scott, let's go back to college. Is this an implicit problem with college campus life, do you think? Because I think a lot, some kids are luckier than others in terms of escaping college without sort of permanent scars of the availability of alcohol and the sort of the lifestyle that you say. But is there just something wrong going on college campuses right now?
Yes. So I think that it's just a microcosm of a larger cultural scene, which is this idea that as an adult or when we get to make our own free choices, that doing whatever what brings pleasure is a choice, is an adult-like decision. And that college is kind of this entryway into adulthood, and that in order to really figure that all out, there's this an immersion into a world where alcohol seems to be the norm, and even and drug use is prevalent as well. A problem, yes, but I think that that's just a natural tendency or transition.
It's just one more evidence,
yeah,
of
I think
what's
it's evidence
going on
of a larger cultural trend.
Well, I just sort of wonder, Scott, if you had been born 100 years ago, the same Scott Weiman, do you think you would have gone through the same crisis?
I'm sure I would have found a way. It all
found
depends,
a way to the crisis, not through the crisis as much as to the crisis.
I like to think that
part of your story.
Yes, you know, think that we see sometimes we can point to cultural trends in our current time to think that, you know, wow, we've got a lot of temptation available. But we were just talking about St. Augustine and other saints who lived amongst great temptation.
So good. Yeah. You're not going to be pointing the finger at culture and our life and 21st century trends to say this is all because of, I mean, it's still ultimately our own individual choices that we're making.
Yeah. And I think just as Augustine would say, depictive of a restlessness that is with a lack of a culture that lacks God, I think, and especially maybe you see it on college campuses more. So maybe that is a cultural trend that points towards what's happening on college campuses. But a culture that lacks God lacks something to feed that restlessness.
Right, to anchor us. Okay, so we are going to continue this great conversation with Scott Wieman about his book, The 12 Steps and the Sacraments. We're going to get into the sacramental part. We've been laying the foundation for his great story, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery. And we'd like to hear from you. So if you want to go to our Facebook page, you can post any comments or questions for Scott on that page, and we will get to them as soon as we can. I know Scott appreciates hearing from others who can relate to his struggle and to his recovery. Again, his book is called The 12 Steps and the Sacraments, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery. And I want to clarify too, Scott, that you grew up a young Catholic man.
Eastern Christmas Catholic.
Okay, stay with us for more of our time with Scott Wieman. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Celebrating, exploring, and restoring our Catholic identity. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hello there, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to Call Me Catholic. I am Peggy Normandin, and we are enjoying the company of Scott Wieman in the studio today. Scott is the author of The 12 Steps and the Sacraments, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery, and he is the founder of Catholic in Recovery. CatholicInRecovery.com, a nonprofit organization that reaches out and supports those who are suffering from addictive, destructive behavior and offers them a hand up and a path out. Hey, Scott, I came across this quote from St. John Paul II that just kind of reminded me of some of your journey there. He says, "I plead with you, never give up on hope, never doubt, never tire, and never become discouraged." So you've been telling us about your journey into alcohol, which started when you were age 17. And then in 2011, something changed. Mm-hmm. And you did wake up that you were saying how you woke up so many mornings and said, today's the day.
Yeah.
But in 2011, you did have that day.
Yes, I was very much the relationship that I was in that I described that was really the most important thing in my life. It was my idol. This woman that I was dating who I thought could kind of save me or something like that. She was the last good thing that I felt like I had in my life was slipping away. And upon just, again, deceitfulness and behavior, alcoholic, drug, addicted behavior that was dishonest, a number of things, she had enough. And, in one day, in one moment, in one instance, kind of came and, you know, after like that last chance, like that 385th chance, saw me in a place where just was hopeless. And that's what I looked me in the eye and she said, "Scott, you are hopeless." And I felt that, you know, because I had tried to change. There was some attempts that I made to drink like a gentleman. And, you know, I was seeing my life just falling apart, these things that I worked hard for. And
it owned you at this point.
Yeah, relationships. I didn't know. I was so scared. Couldn't really share with anyone else what was going on because I was prideful, too. So prideful. I had this image of myself as someone that was successful or had at least a lot of potential. And so I didn't want to share.
And indeed you did.
Yeah,
you do.
I do. Yeah, I can own that today. Mm-hmm. But upon this relationship falling apart and seeing it, just, you know, it was the last thing. And she had done what she had to do, a woman that I am really indebted to and has given me the greatest gift that anyone's given me, my sobriety. The next day, I took my little beach cruiser bicycle, which was one of the only things that I owned. I was strapped
financially. You got it if you're living in San Diego.
That's right. And rode it down to the beach, the nearby Mission Bay, kind of collapsed there. I described the scene in my book and elsewhere, too, where I called my mom and my dad, a couple of my closest friends from back home, and just told them what they already knew, that my life falling apart had, you know, become unmanageable and that I needed help. I didn't think that I was capable of getting help. I had tried before. Some attempts at recovery and sobriety that just didn't last. I thought I was terminally unique and that, but I was willing to try. And I was also willing to be held accountable.
Which are steps in the 12-step process.
Necessary part, yeah. Mm-hmm. So at that phone call, I had someone's phone number in my phone that could bring me to a recovery meeting the next day. I was determined to go, and I was determined also to stay accountable to these people, my friends and family, to tell them, I said, "I'm going to hopefully call you every day going forward. Just to tell you that I hadn't drank yet that day and hadn't drank the night before, hopefully."
Were your family and friends aware of this problem? I mean, maybe you thought they weren't. You lived in that deception. But were they, in fact, aware of it?
Yes, certainly to an extent. They knew about the lost relationships, the schooling opportunities, the potential, the DUIs and things like that. I don't know if, you know, it's so hard, though. I never really was around any sober people, like sober alcoholics. So I never in my life had seen someone. I didn't really know that there was this kind of like underbelly of life, recovery of people who were sinners and are making daily efforts to become saints. Mm-hmm. And so addiction wasn't a word or wasn't thrown around in my vocabulary that often. I never really thought about it.
Yeah. So you just drank too much. That was kind of it. So your first direction was toward the AA organization, the 12 steps. How did that lead into your full recovery through the church?
Sure. So I showed up at a 12-step group and was very bashful, was just a mess. Again, thought I was terminally unique, but willing to give whatever a try,
terminally
willing to give
unique.
This a try. And I got to one meeting that next day, and they, you know, when I got to the staircase, second story meeting, I heard laughter and camaraderie coming from above and thought, I have got to be in the wrong place.
Yeah.
If these people know how I feel right now, there's no reason anyone has any reason to be laughing.
Yeah.
Got there, though, and just was present, you know, hardly to some extent. But afterwards, we held hands. We prayed the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer, a prayer that I was very familiar with growing up nominally Catholic, and mm-hmm. felt this presence of being at home.
Mm-hmm.
A tear ran down my eye afterwards. A gentleman who would have been the last guy that I would have picked out of the crowd came and darted towards me, looked me in the eye
after
that meeting.
Is this the man you call Brock in your book?
This is not. No,
oh, no.
This is a man that I'll call Michael in my book.
Okay.
Yes, and Michael came and looked me in the eye, and he said, Scott, I know exactly how you feel. You don't ever have to drink again. And that was a game changer. Previously in my life, people were telling me, and I was telling myself, like, you shouldn't drink again. You have all these rational reasons not to drink again. Look at all the laundry list of things that you've lost as a result. Like, the girl, like, can't you give it up for her? That was the message that I was receiving before. But when it was someone that said those five words, I know how you feel,
mm-hmm.
that meant a lot to me. And so we walked.
You didn't feel terminally unique anymore. You felt like you had a brother in the effort.
That's right. Yeah. And so we spent a lot of time together working through really the basic principles of addiction recovery. He would carry his Bible with him. And it was one of these, it was something new to me, a very worn and used Bible. It had earmarks. It was written in. It was. We were referring back from the text of the basic text of recovery to the Bible and all these features, these things. And I was still, now don't get me wrong, really, really focused on getting this ex-girlfriend back.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that in order to do so, I would have to be sober for like 30 days, at least look like I was sober for like mm-hmm. 30 days and be seen in the Catholic Church. So just be a good Catholic boy.
Okay.
And so I got involved at my church, my parish, the young adult ministry at St. Bridget Parish in San Diego. Shout out to all those in San Diego that are listening.
Yeah, he says they have a fantastic young adult group there, better than any other ministry going on there. So if you're a young adult looking for fellowship, go to St. Bridget's in San Diego.
There you go. So I went to St. Bridget's and hoping that I could win my ex-girlfriend back.
And was she attending church there?
She was. And in some ways, though, I needed to give her space. This is all this crazy strategy. I'm insane up here.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, if I'm an usher, what's the best way for me to get seen? Be an usher. Passing baskets around at the 9 a.m. Mass. So I did that. And also I knew that would help me be accountable to going to Mass every Sunday, which was not
a good instinct.
A part of my routine.
Yeah, good instinct.
This gentleman, Brock, though, who I had met a few months prior in an attempt to kind of do some patchwork on the relationship. We were doing some things in a small group Bible study. I called Brock, whose number I did have in my phone, and said, Brock, I don't know if you remember me or not, but we met a couple months ago. Are you still leading the Bible study on Wednesday nights at church? And he said, yeah, we are. And there's a Wednesday that I called him. He said, come on down. And Brock, in a way that I owe a lot to him, you know, just discipled me. He shared with me. I didn't know Jesus, but I knew this guy, Brock.
Yeah.
And I knew Brock knew Jesus.
Right.
And so I tried to, you know, spend time with him and really walk with him. And he accompanied me through, you know, through, first of all, those difficult times and just getting through the first few days, weeks, months of sobriety.
So you went to church. You were on this road to recovery. And you went to church kind of for superficial reasons initially.
Sure.
But now you're sort of settling in
mm-hmm.
and you're finding a home there. And you're being drawn into the liturgy and the ministries.
Yeah, it was beautiful, too. The liturgy was changing a little bit. The missal.
We were getting new lingo.
Yeah, so everyone at church was holding the word. I didn't know any of the words, and I kind of felt like a little bit of an outsider that way, you know, as we're reciting the prayers and such. So, but now everyone's holding these cards, and we're all starting from scratch. So that was actually really nice.
We
good
needed
timing.
Two cards back then.
Good timing on God's part,
and
yeah.
with your spirit. Okay,
that's
got
right,
it,
yeah.
got it. So then you started seeing this relationship between the sacraments and the 12 steps.
That's right.
And in fact, in your book, what you do is you lay out the 12 steps that are part of the AA creed, and you attach it to a sacrament, four of the seven sacraments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you do in this book, which is fantastic. So did that come to you all at once, or was that something that you started to grow back into the sacraments and then you understood the relationship?
Yeah, that was something that Michael was helping me with, especially as, you know, knowing that I was getting involved in the church and helping me understand the sacraments in a way that made sense on the recovery side, mm-hmm. using the 12 steps. I was also seeing people who are making adult decisions to become Catholic and going through the RCIA process. Mm-hmm. And a little bit envious of that, thinking, you know, I took it for granted growing up, all the, you know, the sacraments of initiation that I had gone through. But I've seen these people, adult decisions, going through, putting in the work, really coming to know Jesus in a new way.
Yeah.
It took me a little while before I realized that what I was doing and working through the 12 steps, admitting my powerlessness and need for a higher power, Lord, God, Jesus Christ, and just being baptized and submersed, plunged into that, if you will. And then through the process of really lifestyle, mindset, and attitude changes through making moral inventories, looking inward, and really taking a self-discovery, sharing what I find with God, myself, and another human being, which we call confession in the Catholic Church.
I was going to say, so at what point did you go back into the confessional? I mean, was this a ways into it, or did you feel drawn to it quickly?
I got into confession early. But in a way that was just kind of spot check confession.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I knew, you know, of course, there's a lot of other things outside of alcohol and drugs that needed to be cleaned up and that still do need to be cleaned up.
Well, it's an ongoing process,
Scott. Of course.
We're all on it.
Yep. And so some spot check confessions. It was about a year into recovery, though. I was thoroughly worked through the fourth step, which is a thorough moral inventory of ourselves, really kind of seeing our side of the street on those relationships that may be struggling, as well as taking an inventory of our sex conduct and fear. Sharing it with another person is the fifth step, which I then did with a priest and made a time for kind of a general confession.
Mm-hmm.
And then he helped me work through then the next steps, which were to really ask God to remove other defects of character. And through that process and really kind of coming to ask God for clarity and wisdom, and know that it's only Him that can relieve me of that. Mm-hmm. But then I've got to do some other things. I've got to make amends for the wrongs that I've done. And, you know, there were plenty of them. And healing, taking responsibility to heal the relationships that my behavior related to alcoholism and drug addiction certainly created. And so in order to fully complete that confession, making amends or doing full penance, if we would call it in the church, was a really, really important part to bring it full circle.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting, throughout the course of your book, you tell the stories of encounters that you had with people, some who were recovering, like yourself, some who were just good souls that reached out to you and wanted to engage with you, which really made the difference. And after finishing the book, I thought, it's really the people that God is working through.
That's right.
That make that difference. I mean, you tell the story of Dorothy, and of course you change the names to kind of keep their identity confidential. But I love the story of how Dorothy just reached out to you and met with you. And
Dorothy is her real name. She's passed away.
Hey, Dorothy. Oh, she's gone.
Yeah. Okay. However, we'll get to the rest of the story. My life comes together. I ended up meeting a beautiful woman who's now my wife.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. We were about a year and a half into our marriage and about 7 months into our baby who was born, living in Jacqueline's
womb. Oh, that's wonderful.
Her name's Dorothy. We've named our baby Dorothy.
That's lovely. So you know she's a girl.
Yes, we know.
Oh, congratulations, Scott.
I'm getting ahead of ourselves, though, but I had to share that. I couldn't resist.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that.
So having this relationship with my friend Dorothy, who I'd see in the rooms, in recovery rooms, like 40-some years sober, had this really wise, unassuming style to her. I'd see her at Mass on Sundays as well, and then after Mass we would go get coffee together, mm-hmm. chatting, and she really appreciated the vicarious nature of our relationship, kind of living through the girls I was dating or something, whatever kind of the problem of the day was, finance or romance or whatever it mm-hmm. might be. And just sharing, you know, subtly, just you're not in control, Scott. It's, you know, leave it up to God. Or she would point out, sounds like self-will run riot, Scott, or something mm-hmm. like that. And just sharing the self-centered nature.
Self-will run riot. Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, so there's a lot of self-centeredness that really is focused upon in some of the spiritual work, in working through the 12 steps. And the only way that I found in order to alleviate that self-centeredness is to surrender to God. And that's often through the relationship with other people. And God reveals himself and his will in my life often through the relationships that I have, the doors that may or may not open.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, and we're talking about the Acts of the Apostles as we're reading through Easter, we're reading about men like Paul and his friend Barnabas, who then are having opportunities to really meet people and figuring out that maybe the people that they're meant to help and serve aren't the ones who are the high, you know, high and mighty in authority, but rather those that look and want it. And
those you encounter. I mean, those are the people that we're meant to engage with, or the people we encounter. We can't go out looking for the people that we want.
Yeah.
You know, they're put in our life.
Yeah. So what I love about recovery fellowships is the kind of the early church mentality of it is 12-step groups were founded upon one addict sharing the good news with another. And that is really how it's been, how it's sustained itself.
What, I think it goes back to 1939. Bill Wilson, isn't he the founder? And I have such respect for this man because he didn't have AA then. He created it. And what a salvation it has been for so many people. And the spirituality, even if you don't, you come to it without any spirituality, you have to defer to the greater power.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, there's a
lot of people come to God through that spirituality.
Yeah, and it's how I did. The 12 steps of addiction and recovery have saved my life. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. And being able to complement that with my faith, the sacramental life of the church, the teachings of the church and the traditions, the rich tradition, I think were really, really important, especially during that first year or two as I was really finding myself and finding my identity. I don't know if I would have completely landed on my identity as a beloved son of God with whom he is well pleased if it wasn't for the church in addition to my recovery. And so I found that there is a need, a holistic way to really find new life and find, because there are other, let's, you know, in my life and in some secular recovery circles, there are some temptations to just kind of alternate addictions or,
swap one out for another, you mean?
Sure. And that's, I mean, at the nature and the heart of it, the 12 steps accounts for that. But, you know, if we're just focusing on one thing at a time, if I'm only focusing on my alcohol addiction, then there are a lot of other things in place, and we haven't even gotten there yet, but, you know, struggling with pornography and sex addiction, gambling, food-related things, which most alcoholics and addicts are kind of a more than one of the above kind of people, including myself, and that I think that we need to be able to look at the entirety of it. And so one of the things that I was struggling with as I was getting sober was coming to, okay, I wasn't drinking anymore. I wasn't using drugs anymore, which was a huge, that was huge progress that I need to.
But you want, but you lacked that stimulus then.
But yeah, and so, but I was still acting out using pornography and, and my relationship with women needed a lot of work. You know, like the way that I was trying to feed my ego in many ways, needed to be looked at. And so upon this foundation of recovery, I was able to look at other aspects of my life and kind of to give it a holistic feel and also realize that, wow, like there, the sacraments of the Catholic Church, Christ lives and dwells among us in ways that we can tangibly experience through a face-to-face confession with a priest or through the reception of the Eucharist or adoration of the Eucharist. And then in our confirmation, we're asked to go make disciples of all nations, sharing the good news. And for me, if I'm sharing the good news, I also kind of had to share some of the bad news, or at least, the, you know, what it was that I experienced that helped propel me there. And so I love it. I love opportunities like this.
Well, look at Paul. I mean, look at his past. Could there have been a worse past to have to deal with to go in and be an evangelist for Christ?
Yeah.
I mean, what a terrible burden. And of course, he had other issues in, that were burdens for him. But I mean, if God can take a Paul, a Saul, and turn him into a Paul, and we see his statue on one side of the Vatican with Peter on the other side, he can do anything with us, and he wants to do something with us. And I think sometimes he works best when we are so raw that we don't have any other resources left.
Yeah. So this interesting dichotomy exists and existed, and I kind of had seen, first, not many people who were writing about or kind of showing that overlap between the Catholic Church and some, and the 12 steps in a way that was really storytelling. So I was interested in doing that, interested in learning more. I also found this interesting dichotomy in the church. We've, you know, plenty of people who need recovery but think, I'm not that bad. And then plenty of people who are in recovery are looking for maybe a deeper relationship with their higher power, but look to the church and think, I'm not that good. Like there, in both, you know, there's so much wisdom and power between the two. And one of the things, so Catholic in Recovery has come as a result of this and helping really provide
That's
resources.
That's your nonprofit organization. It's called CatholicInRecovery.com, right?
Yep. Catholic in Recovery is the organization. And you can find us at CatholicInRecovery.com, as well as on Facebook and Instagram. Yeah. And through Catholic in Recovery, we found a need, whereas a lot of in the church, we don't really know what to do with this problem. I could list statistics and all the different problems, opioid addiction and epidemics throughout the country, pornography and sex, a huge problem, alcoholism, drug addiction. Like the church doesn't really, in many cases, have a hard, like, know what to do with that.
Yeah.
Pope Francis asks that the church is a field hospital in times of battle. the church in some ways has been a little bit more of a dispatcher, kind of just dispatching some of that work where we have the sacraments, we are healers, and we also have, I think, as a way, a need and an obligation to serve those that are in great need. And so when people come to the church, however they do that, seeking help and seeking resources, shouldn't we have that?
We should. And you know what else we should be doing, Scott, is we should be forming little soldiers before they get to the point of needing recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're all going to need recovery at some point. But I mean, a little bit has to be done at the front end, too, working with young people, sort of preparing them for college, preparing them for what they're going to encounter in high school, and giving them an alternate, you know, starting this early.
Yeah. It's hard to have conversations like this, though, isn't it? And really getting in, I think, you know, whether it's a family, a parent talking with their child, a youth minister talking with one of their students, or a pastor talking to the congregation, touching on some of these subjects is difficult. It's
I have to give a shout out to some of our pastors here in the Diocese of Orange that I have heard address the pornography addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that must be very uncomfortable on a Sunday morning to look out at a congregation with families out there and say that bluntly,
mm-hmm.
that pornography addiction is a problem and it's a trend and it's lurking in our backgrounds and
mm-hmm.
we need to bring it out into the light and burn it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard them, but there's not a lot of recourse other than confession,
yeah.
you know, for
yeah.
those things.
So fellowship, honesty, accountability, those are really important parts of it. And that, I mentioned self-will run riot.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we have to
thank
do.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Yeah.
Although she borrowed that from somewhere.
It's all borrowed.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, all the,
yeah. It's all recycled. That's good.
So fellowship, accountability, and really smashing that ego is a really important thing. I think in many times, whether it's a family member or someone within our church, or we want to present ourselves looking good.
Yeah.
And whatever kind of struggles, we all have them. But, you know, we sometimes tend to judge our insides by everyone else's outsides. And so
yeah.
we don't see that anyone else has a problem. So I don't want to speak up or I don't want to speak on behalf of a loved
one.
It
is uncomfortable. Yeah, it's uncomfortable. And yet, look at you. I mean, you were uncomfortable with it at the beginning. And now, you know, it's out there. It's like Jesus says, bring these things out into the light. Don't
yeah.
keep them in the darkness.
I think that it's really important that as a church that our culture shifts, that we can have conversations like this
yeah.
and really and be willing to embrace and just hold the difficulty that is
yeah.
there. Even, I mean, it's easy for me to talk about it because I'm on the other side of some of this stuff. But even in the midst of when someone comes into one of our Catholic and recovery meetings at a parish, they're walking in with a lot of timidity.
Oh, sure. And you can relate to that.
I can.
So again, your organization is Catholic in Recovery. You can go to CatholicInRecovery.com. And what kind of resources do you offer parishes?
Setting up a foundation for a fellowship and for a place where people can find new life and through combining the spiritual principles of addiction recovery as well as liturgical themes, scripture from Sunday's Mass readings. We gather.
So compatible.
Yeah. And we gather. We have different types of meetings, some general recovery meetings where people, alcoholics, drug addicts, pornography and sex addicts, gambling addicts, codependents, overeaters, you name it.
Anything for tab drinkers?
Yes. Well, yeah, we can. Or anyone that's just there
yeah.
that just wants someone to relate, that's just like speaking honestly.
Yeah.
And so we gather and just share experience, strength, and hope with each other. Okay. And finding a lot of similarity in some of those maybe different symptoms of the same spiritual malady that we all have. And that's that restlessness that we've spoken of.
What would you advise a person who is witnessing someone in their life that they think, I would like to intervene, but I don't know how to do this delicately. I don't know how to do it sensitively. What would be the first step that you would suggest?
Getting help for themselves. That's it's a family disease, no doubt. And there's a lot of weight held by family members that are in a place like that, whether it's a parent,
okay.
a sibling, a child of an addict.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of confusion and chaos that takes place. First, typically denial, it couldn't be happening to me. And then coming to grips with the fact that this probably is happening to me.
Yeah.
And also holding that together with the same thing that an addiction is not a moral referendum on who someone is.
Right.
So being able to separate the disease, the illness, the sin.
From the behavior.
From the person, yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay, well that's good. And I will refer, I think this book is a great way to start too. The 12 Steps and the Sacraments, A Catholic Journey Through Recovery by Scott Wieman. Really appreciate your testimony today, Scott. Also go to his website, CatholicInRecovery.com. And we all can use some help in living with this and helping build up a culture that can help each other through these problems and also prevent them from happening in the first place.
That's right. That's right. And as you started the show with, hope.
And hope. Yeah. And you know what? Let's close this conversation with the Serenity Prayer, which is part of the AA process. And he says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. That's such a beautiful concept.
Can I finish the Serenity Prayer?
Yes, please.
Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as he did the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen.
Amen, Scott. Thank you for closing the most important part of that prayer. And clearly it's a very important part of your life because you said it with such great ease and with no notes at all. Hey, thank you, Scott, and God bless your ministry. Come back and see us again. We are excited to welcome another new station to our EWTN radio family. Hello to everyone listening on AM 1160, The Quest, serving Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, you can start your own radio station, too. You can build a new station. That's a start, or purchase an existing radio station. EWTN will provide you programming free of charge, and you'll be able to say, I'm a radio station manager. That's pretty cool. Give it a thought. Pray for Mother Angela. Angelica's inspiration, she will always deliver. So again, welcome to all our new listeners now hearing us on AM 1160, The Quest, serving Atlanta, Georgia, home of the LaBeoufs, the newest member of the EWTN radio family. That's my family. Hey, join us next week, same day, same time, for more good news from our good faith. Until then, I'm Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic.
You've been listening to Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin, live from the Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove, California. Call Me Catholic is a co-production of EWTN Radio and Orange County Catholic Radio. Heard weekly on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.